This is a Triple J podcast.
Hey, it's Dave Marchese. This is the Hack Podcast. How often do you speak to your mom or your dad? Is it every week? Every day? Maybe it's a few times a day. You're just constantly messaging on the phone. What's the boundary with the conversation as well? Like, do you just talk about the mundane stuff in your life like work, or you get into everything? You're talking about dating, even sex. How do you know if you're too close to your parents? We're going to get into this one later on the Hack Podcast because we put the call out recently asking how close you are with your parents, and I was pretty surprised to hear some of the experiences, what some of you have told us about the kind of stuff that you share with mum or dad. You're going to hear about some of those soon. Also coming up, the debate over logging native forests in Australia, why some experts are saying it would be good for the economy if we banned native logging across the board. Some states have done it. Will it go further? First, though.
Hack. There's potentially lives saved.
On Triple J.
Where are we at with pill testing in Australia? Because it feels like every year there's some headline about it, right? Like over the weekend, Queensland becomes the first state in the country to offer free drug testing at the Rabbits Eat Lettuce Festival. So how did it go? And is it going to continue? Well, Angus McIntosh has been looking into it.
In an Australian first, pill testing will go ahead at the Groove in the Move Festival.
The clip you're listening to isn't from this weekend. It's from April 2018, so 6 years ago. That's how long the debate about testing people's drugs at music festivals has been going. Back then, it was a one-dayer, Groove in the Move in Canberra. It did it again in 2019. And now, Queensland's gone further at the four-day Rabbits Eat Lettuce event near Warwick. So, how did it go?
It was very well received. And
this is Eric Lemire-Pike. He's the festival director, and he reckons there were 206 tests done over the weekend.
And it was great that Rabbits Eat Lettuce was able to lead the charge there, and hopefully all the other states start to follow suit after Queensland's made this great first step.
There's a tragic backstory here. In 2019, 24-year-old Desan Tarbert and 22-year-old Ebony Greening died at Rabbits Eat Lettuce. They were discovered inside their tent. The coroner found they died of an overdose. Doctors like David Caldicott reckon pill testing will prevent more deaths.
I think it has a direct effect on people who consume drugs, but perhaps more importantly, it encourages young people to start having a dialogue, having a discussion with people they might not normally have discussions with about drug use in Australia.
Rabbits Eat Lettuce is the first multi-day festival in Australia to set up a pill testing service. Working out of a temporary cabin, chemists spent the Easter weekend running tests on people's drugs, telling them what's actually gone into them. As part of the testing, the Queensland Police Service also said it wouldn't use sniffer dogs or do body searches. The service was also anonymous, so anyone lining up wouldn't be approached by police.
I think it was a perfect model, you know. We had EMT, doctors, nurses, paramedics, and also PTA sharing that data as it comes in with our medical provider, made for a very safe event.
Lee was one of 4,000 people at Rabbits Eat Lettuce.
I think it's really, really exciting. It's a service that we've all, you know, wished was available for a long time.
And she reckons it helps people know what risks they're taking.
People are going to take things regardless, whether they're at home, whether they're at a festival. And it's like, if anything that you can make something safer, just why wouldn't you?
It's not just at festivals that Queensland is trying something new. The state's also setting up a permanent site in Brisbane in Bowen Hills. But it might not survive the October election. The state opposition is worried that pill testing encourages people to take drugs.
You're listening to Hack on Triple J.
Angus McIntosh with that update. So how far away are we to getting widespread pill testing across Australia? Well, let's ask an expert. Dr. Amy Haley is from Swinburne Centre for Human Psychopharmacology. She's with us now. G'day, Amy. Thanks for coming on Hack.
No worries. Thanks for having me.
As Angus just said, we're 6 years on from the first pill testing trial at Groove in the Moo. Are you surprised that it's not more readily available in 2024?
I am, yes, because it seems that while public debate continues to go around this issue, drug checking has been accepted for quite some time among people in the scientific and healthcare community, as a really pragmatic and realistic approach to reduce harm for people who choose to use drugs.
So why do you think it is that it's taking so long to roll out?
Australia has had a historically pretty antiquated abstinence-only approach to drug use, and this is kind of closely intertwined with an enforcement rather than a healthcare or a harm prevention approach. And what that means is that sort of people are often more hesitant to get their drugs checked. There's less inclination for people to want to seek help when they do get themselves into trouble. And so I think that's why there has been a little bit of pushback around seeing this or moving this from an enforcement to a health promotion approach.
So what do you make of the testing services that were available at this festival, Rabbit's Eat Lettuce, over the weekend? Like, did you think that that was a good model?
Yeah, they're fantastic. Research always shows us that it's a useful and a pragmatic way to provide people with a reliable and judgment-free space where they can make an informed decision about their drug use. And it also gives people the agency to make an informed decision based on objective feedback and the opportunity to potentially modify their behaviour to keep themselves and their friends safe.
I mean, one of the things that people do worry about, stress about, is that, you know, pill testing might increase drug use. Is there any evidence of that at all?
No, there's not. And I don't think there's any real realistic scenario when these services wouldn't be in greater demand in the future. So I would seriously implore policymakers and politicians to look at the evidence and success of these kinds of programs to action real change around this issue, because it's only going to become more necessary in the future.
Do you think that, we are seeing this kind of shift in society where pill testing will be seen more as a health issue rather than anything else? Like, Queensland Police made it clear before this festival that that's how they would be treating it. How does that impact harm reduction at big music events, do you reckon?
I think it's very slowly changing, where we're seeing more targeted support services that are intended to provide people with an educative space to make an informed choice rather than a punitive approach at law enforcement. And it allows people to change and modify their behaviour based on new and impartial information. It should be treated and managed as a health issue, not a legal one. And that's really the only way we're going to see any progress on this moving forward.
Well, look, we appreciate your take on this. Dr. Amy Haley from Swinburne, thank you very much for coming on Hack.
No worries. Thanks for having me.
Hack. There are about 1,000 jobs that need to be moved from native forest logging into plantations.
On Triple J.
At the beginning of this year, two states put an end to native forest logging, cutting down trees in native forests for timber or pulp. Western Australia and Victoria. And now the heat's on other states like New South Wales to do the same. But it's not as simple as that, because there are some timber workers in regional New South Wales who say they're already out of work because environmentalists are disrupting the industry. They're worried about what this is going to mean for their communities if logging is outlawed there. But the activists on the other side are saying, well, they're not going anywhere. So where does that leave us? Bernadette Clark has got more from Batemans Bay on the New South Wales South Coast.
If you've ever visited the New South Wales South Coast, you might know it best for its beaches. But for some families, this place is all about timber. Logging has secured jobs for generations of families here since the 1900s.
This industry is a great industry to be in, always has been. Yes, it's hard work, but we've always enjoyed what we do.
But timber workers like Ian Slater are now fearful for their future. While the New South Wales government says it has no plan to phase out native forest logging, the industry says it's already under threat. Stop work orders, which lasted up to 160 days, have prevented loggers from operating in Tallaganda and Flat Rock state forests.
The stop work orders have been disastrous for our family business, because the EPA turned up and did an audit. They found a deceased possum, which actually wasn't on my job. They came back and issued us with a stand down immediately.
The stop works were ordered last year by the Environment Protection Authority over concerns about the endangered greater glider. The EPA, which is a state agency, reckons it was necessary to make sure proper measures were in place to protect the animal, which has already been really impacted by bushfires. For about 6 months, workers felt like they were in limbo. For logging contractor Ian Slater, it meant the end of his career, and he had to lay off his sons too.
As of today, I'm pretty much bankrupt, and I have to put the boys off and my son will probably lose his house. I feel for my employees because they've been so loyal to me, especially my son, and always dreamt of handing the business over to them.
Being out of work month after month put Ian out of pocket by tens of thousands of dollars. He says local communities would struggle without logging and that young people were already moving away.
They don't want to be in the timber industry because it's uncertainty. So they've moved away. Ian struggles to get an under-18 football team.
But others feel very differently about native forest logging.
I sat on the balcony with my dad and we watched as the fire came through the forest. And then about 6 months later, we sat in the exact same spot and watched tree after tree getting knocked down.
22-year-old Takisa Frank is talking to me about logging in her own backyard, the Broomen State Forest.
I've lived around this forest my entire life. I learnt to swim in the Clyde River, which is a river that runs through this forest. I'm also a proud Aboriginal person, and with that, I have a deep connection to country and caring for our culture and land. And I think that's one of the reasons why I am so connected to this forest. I want to see it protected.
Takisa founded the Broomen State Conservation Group. I asked her how she felt about the future of jobs here.
I do feel for workers that are losing this job in the industry. But the other side of that is that we also have to look at our tourism jobs. So the South Coast is known for tourism in the area. And what logging our forest is doing is reducing tourism because people come to the South Coast to hang out in our forest, to go to the beautiful rivers and the beaches.
Environmental advocates like Takisa and organisations like the Worldwide Fund for Nature are blaming job losses on the New South Wales government. Dr. Stuart Blanch, policy manager to WWF, says their lack of a transition plan is impacting workers.
I'm sorry people are losing their jobs over the need to protect greater gliders, but really it's the state government's responsibility to fund the complete transition out of native forest logging into plantations.
A plantation is an area of land where trees have been planted to then be logged. But logging in New South Wales is currently also done in native state forests that environmentalists want left alone.
There's about 5,000 hectares of land on the south coast that could be planted to plantations. That's a lot of jobs. That's high-tech jobs involved in both plantation development and harvesting and wood manufacturing.
In a statement to HACC, a spokesperson for the New South Wales Minister for Agriculture, Tara Moriarty, said the state government is committed to delivering the right balance between protecting the environment and sustaining state forests.
This is HACC on Triple J.
Bernadette Clark there. I want to get into this a little more with an expert. David Lindenmeyer is a forest ecology professor at ANU. He's with us now. Professor Lindenmeyer, thank you very much for coming on HACC. You've written in a piece recently that getting rid of native forest logging can not only be a good thing for native animals, for the climate, but also for Australia's economy. How does that work?
Almost everywhere in Australia, native forest logging has been a major loss maker. Tasmania's economy has had to deal with $1.5 billion worth of losses. In Victoria, there's been large losses there. For example, in the last couple of years, Vic Forest cost the Victorian economy $269 million. New South Wales is pretty much the same. In the year 2019-20, Forestry Corporation of New South Wales was handed more than $250 million and it still made a loss of $28 million. So essentially what's happening is the industry is heavily subsidised, it employs very few people, and it's generally making mostly wood chips and paper pulp, which does not really return much to the economy. In fact, in many cases, it costs more to cut the trees down than you make from the timber.
What's the answer here? Because in terms of the products that we get from logging, whether it's wood, paper, we still need those things. So what do we do to do it in a more sustainable way?
Well, we source them from plantations. And in fact, already nearly 90% of the sawn timber in Victoria and New South Wales. So sawn timber is what makes roof trusses, floorboards, furniture, those kinds of things. That's already coming from plantations. And most of what comes from native forests is wood chips, paper pulp, box liners, those kinds of things. And so we can readily substitute what comes from native forests, either from conifer plantations or from plantation eucalypt
And is that what other countries have done around the world, phased out native logging, forest logging, and moved into plantations?
Well, the best example is our nearest neighbour across the ditch. It's New Zealand. They realised, woke up to this 20 years ago and made that transition very quickly. And what we see all over the world is that increasingly plantations are making up more and more and more of the wood market. Now, yes, there's an increase in demand for some wood products as time goes on, but we are able to recycle paper better. We're able to recycle cardboard and other materials better. The straightforward thing to do is to exit the industry as quickly as possible. And that gives people more certainty. The longer that you hang on to an industry that's in its death throes, the worse it is, not only for the workers in that industry because of a lack of certainty, but also for the taxpayer because they've got to keep forking out more and more money to prop up an industry that is essentially falling over.
I mean, one of the big concerns that's always raised when we talk about ending native forest logging is the impact it has on communities that rely on the industry. How do you make sure that towns don't just suddenly die, that communities aren't left high and dry? Because that is a legitimate concern of a lot of people who are listening.
Yes, it is a legitimate concern. And so what you need to have then is the transition structure in place. We will still need people working in forests, even if we're not cutting them down. We will need people to manage those resources for fire protection because logging makes forests more prone to high severity fire. But we need to have people managing the forests to increase the amount of carbon that's stored in them, to deal with feral animals like deer, because we have exploding populations of feral deer all through New South Wales forests, but also in Victoria and elsewhere in Tasmania. More infrastructure there for ecotourism, because people want to spend more time in Australia visiting the natural environment in this place. And in parts of Australia's native forest estate, the forest has not regenerated properly after previous logging or after previous repeated fire. So we are going to need a workforce to put that forest back together again, which is suffering from the last 50 or 60 years of degradation due to intensive logging.
You mentioned before that logging makes forests more prone to fires. What's the evidence behind that? How does that work?
We first started working on this in 2009 after the Black Saturday fires in Victoria, where so many people sadly lost their lives, looking at the severity of fire. Now, severity is the amount to which the forest is burnt back in a fire. So it's different from intensity, which is the amount of heat produced. So what we see is that a forest that has been logged or a forest that has been thinned typically burns at much higher severity than an intact forest. Now, we saw evidence of this after the 2019-20 fires as well, where intact forests always burnt at lower severity than log forests. And in fact, the difference was so substantial that a logged forest burning under moderate fire weather still burnt at much greater severity than an intact forest burning under extreme conditions. So what happens is that when you log a forest, you leave a lot of debris left in the forest, which adds to fuel loads. The forest becomes hotter, the forest becomes drier, and when it regenerates, it's like a wheat field of trees, and that helps carry the fire from the ground level to the understory to the overstory. There have been widespread calls to thin forests. Now, thinning means taking out some of the trees, and the idea is that those thin forests will be less fire prone, but the scientific data actually shows that the more we thin forests, the more fire prone they get. So widespread thinning of forests is really an own goal. It's an own goal because it makes forests more fire prone. It's an own goal because it makes forests bigger emitters of carbon emissions. And it's an own goal because it eradicates habitat for many important forest-dependent plants and animals.
Well, I've definitely learnt a lot there. I'm sure a lot of people listening have. Thanks for taking the time to have a chat with us. Forest Ecology Professor at ANU, David Lindenmeyer, thank you very much.
It's a pleasure. Thank you.
We've got messages coming through. Someone says it's a shame the arguments for and against logging are so binary. We need to learn to work together, enviro and loggers alike. Another person, I'm an environmental engineer and I agree. Let's keep it to the plantations and stay away from the forest. But someone else says, I think we often forget that reduced logging doesn't equal reduced need for timber. It just means we get more of it from places where there is no legislation protecting sustainable timber, like Indonesia and other places. leading to huge deforestation. It's interesting you say that because these are some of the points that Professor David Lindenmayer has covered in his new book. It's called The Forest Wars. He gets into the backstory of the logging industry, answers questions, aims to dispel myths. If you're into it, it's out now. You can go find it at any bookstore.
Hack.
Hey there, Mom. You are the bomb. There is nobody like you.
On Triple J.
Do you ever think I'm too close with my parents? Or maybe your friends have told you that you share too much. They're more like best friends than Mum or Dad. Is that an issue or is it a good thing? Because some research that was out recently found that young people are increasingly getting closer to their parents. They're relying on them for financial, emotional support. And while in most cases that is a sign of a healthy and mature relationship, as Shalila Medora's been finding out, sometimes maybe you can be just a little too close.
Are you bringing the hairdryer?
Yeah, I'll bring the hairdryer. You're bringing the straightener. Isn't that right?
Yeah.
Lauren from Nam, Melbourne, is super close to her parents.
Don't fill it up too much because we may want to bring some stuff back with us from Italy.
Yeah, very true.
She's over at their place now, packing with her mum, Jo.
I'm actually about to leave on a trip to visit family in Italy with them, and I will spend majority of the 6 weeks with them, which is kind of nuts to think about.
Their relationship wasn't always so close.
When I moved out of their place in 2021, like I really wanted some space from them, kind of went, you know, a couple of months without seeing them.
Lauren says she realised after she moved out how similar she is to them and how much she enjoys their company.
I'm over there most nights for dinner. Yeah, that honestly just really great people to be around, and I'm really happy that I have their relationship with them like that.
According to American company Pew Research, young adults now are pretty damn close to their parents. Both young adults and their parents report enjoying each other's company and having a satisfying relationship. And when we asked you, you confirmed it.
I'm super close with my mum, and it only happened kind of recently. I recently had a pap smear and I was really scared about it. And so my mum was like, FaceTime me. And so throughout the whole time, I was on FaceTime with her and she was able to coach me through it.
We love to go out dancing together, sometimes flirting with the same guys and other times wing-womaning each other, which is really fun. She is my ride or die. And honestly, I couldn't ask for a better relationship with her.
We lived together, we got weight loss surgery together, and now she is gifting me a tummy tuck and a breast reduction. She's going to get her own plastics and I'm going to get my BBL.
A few years ago, I was finishing off some waxing units at beauty school and my intimate wax model no-showed, unfortunately. Now, after quite a bit of back and forthing with mum to decide whether this was too awkward to complete, she soldiered through. Safe to say, I never thought that I would be so close to the part that birthed me again.
Okay, so maybe there's such a thing as being too close. And there's being close versus being a bit too hands-on.
The parenting style can be probably, I think the word would be a little more involved, would be how I would describe it.
This is someone we'll call Alex. He's got an Aussie dad and a mum from the Middle East. He says he's noticed a different style of parenting between the two, and that's reflected in the experience of other people with ethnic parents.
The boundaries are not as clear. You are less likely to want to approach them about certain things because of the judgment that comes through from it.
His mum really wants to know what's going on in his life, and that can be a bit full on.
There's just been a few times in my life where I've been contacted by friends of mine and they're like, oh, your mother rang me because she hasn't heard from you for 2 days. And I'm like, she what?
Alex says he loves his mum, but she's got to learn to treat him like an adult.
Yeah, setting boundaries is a difficult thing because they think that that's breaking the bond with you or something.
Hack on Triple J.
Shalila Medora there. Oh, a lot of messages coming through on this one. Someone says, I live with mum and talk to her about everything. She's my bestie. And heaps of messages flooding Hack's Instagram as well. Someone says, there's no such thing as too close. It is healthy to have strong bonds with your family. It's called secure attachment. Someone else, I'm 21, I live at home. Call mum at least once a day, even though I live at home. and we text all the time. And another person, Mum and I are both Scorpios. I'm 24, she's 50. I called her to tell her about my recent date and that I've got thrush. Amazing. So is there such a thing as being too close with your parents? Well, Dr. Charlotte Keating is a clinical psychologist. She's with us now to tell us. Hey, Charlotte, thanks for coming on Hack.
Thank you.
FaceTiming during pretty private medical appointments, getting BBLs together. I mean, is there a boundary here that you shouldn't be jumping over with Mum or Dad?
Oh, look, I think it's interesting and it's different for different people, isn't it? But isn't it just amazing that FaceTime exists in the context of being at a medical appointment and your mum can sort of technologically hold your hand through something that you might otherwise find, you know, quite stressful? It's an interesting world we live in, isn't it?
Yeah, it's definitely things have changed over the years. And hey, if it makes things easier, maybe it's a good thing. Is there any way to know if you may be a little too close with your mum or dad, that things, maybe you need to put some boundaries in place?
Look, it's such a good question, really. And I think my response to that is family relationships are different for different families and indeed, you know, different cultures as well. Some families can have multiple generations, you know, living in the one home. I don't think there is a single approach necessarily to what's too close or what's too separate. And, you know, even as, you know, the community was texting and, you know, making their opinions known, it's really about what feels good for you. I mean, for sure, there are certain recognised, like, developmental milestones that come into play for all of us, you know, and the things as we're sort of getting to that, you know, age of adulthood is really, it's stuff like independence, you know, in the friends you choose, the relationships you choose, the sort of work you do. It might be the beliefs and values and morals you have. I think part of, you know, that healthy kind of relationship that recognises your independence as well as, you know, your sort of connection to them is one that allows for you to have different views and different ideas and to be able to express them. And I think I see a lot of young people sometimes grapple with wanting to, you know, have their own voice and their own opinions and their own sort of choices on matters that might be important to them. And sometimes it can feel like in expressing those, they're either not validated by their parents, whom, you know, they would like the respect and the validation of. And sometimes it can create real tensions in relationships too, sometimes even guilt as well.
Yeah, I mean, someone's messaged in saying, I'm a Gen Zer, I've been estranged from my entire family for 5 years. So no, not so close and not everyone's close. I'm wondering, Charlotte, like if you do have a tough relationship with your parents or one of your parents, is there a way to keep in contact without really bringing them into your life in a way that's going to make things really tough for you?
Yeah, it's such an important question. I think, you know, so many people do have a really close and enjoyable relationship with, you know, their parents and indeed their family, but it's not always the case for everybody and it can create quite some sort of stress, I think, in managing those relationships because, you know, evolutionarily speaking, there is a bit of a desire to often remain connected with parents or family members, even if we've not had, you know, the greatest childhood memories with them or, you know, even adult connection. So I think part of it is working out where you may sit, you know, along the continuum of what you really want or what you might have, you know, really struggled with that creates the discomfort for you in the moment. So it might be trying to get to a stage where you talk with somebody. It could be a trusted person or a counsellor about what has been difficult to try and work through some of it so that you can then also establish, well, in terms of if I want to stay in touch or how you might stay in touch, what does that actually look like? How much time does that look like spending? What sort of environments or contexts does that look like, you know, connecting in? And how will I manage it if I say no and they get upset with me or I feel guilty with how they respond? How do I sort of manage that discomfort or sit with that discomfort? But I think it is really important to know that, you know, you can take time out, you can create some space if the boundaries that you have tried to respectfully and calmly implement are perhaps not, you know, being respected or acknowledged, if that makes sense.
Yeah, look, it's pretty valuable advice. You've got people all over the text line now who are sharing their experiences. Some people who are stoked with the relationship they've got with their mum or dad, they're both parents, saying they're really close. Others saying, look, I'm struggling to relate to this because I've never had a good relationship with my parents. We appreciate your take. Dr. Charlotte Keating, thank you very much for coming on Hack.
Thanks for having me.
Hack on Triple J.
Big response to this one. Someone says, me and my mum are incredibly close. I tell her everything from dates and boys to how I'm feeling, but sometimes her emotional health relies on me and she dumps her problems on me. And another person says, all my friends with one parent are closer with them compared to my friends with two parents. That's interesting. But hey, that's all we've got time for on the Hack Podcast for now. I'll be back tomorrow. I'll catch you then. See ya. Hack.